genocide. To fight it is the blood of a thousand men and women filled in these walls. Limbs twisted and broken, eyes gouged from bloody sockets, flesh burned black.
What's up, guys? This is Jay Scott, and you're listening to World of the Unexplained. Trent is not here with us tonight because of he's got some other issues that he's got to take care of. He may show up later, but until Trent gets here, Chuck is with us. Chuck, you want to? He's gotta step
I got to get back into position over here.
All right, so Chuck's going to co-host with me tonight. Tonight we've got Dr. Pamela Ray Heath. MD and PsyD. She holds a doctorate in psychology with a specialization in parapsychology from Rosebridge Graduate School of Integrative Psychology, now ASPP. She's the author of The PK Zone, as well as journal articles on psychokinesis, place memory, and experiential research. But tonight, she's going to come to talk to us about her new book, Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead. And also joining us on the second hour is going to be her co-author, Dr. John Klimo. So we're looking forward to having him on as well. But I guess right now we'll just bring Pamela on. Pam, how are you?
Doing fine. Thanks for having me.
How was that for an intro? Okay, good. All right. Where to start? This is a big book. You know, I'll have to admit, when I got it, I was a little bit scared.
I think it intimidates a lot of people. We actually could have made it longer.
Oh my God! Yeah. Well, you know, I hadn't seen a book.
We're like, no, please.
I hadn't seen a book this big since I had to read case books in law school. I'm like, oh God.
But it's very simple language.
It is.
It is easy to read. It's meant for the average person, not people who have degrees.
Yeah. Well, it is a good read, and it's very. I don't want to say simplistically laid out, but it's laid out to where any layman can understand it. Even I can understand it, guys. So,
plain language, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's good stuff. Now, I guess I noticed that you go through kind of a historical perspective in the beginning. You talk about Emil Durkheim's book. You talk about some of the things from a historical perspective. You talk about, I think it says suicide was mentioned 6 times in the Bible. You talk about, I was trying to think of the philosopher that I had read. Who was it that killed themselves with the poison?
Socrates,
thank you. I was looking at my producer. He knows all this stuff. And you look back through history and you see what other cultures have thought about suicide and what we think about it today. And I guess that's a good place as any to start. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's been around since, the beginning. There are always going to be people who are depressed or upset and want to find a way out. And it'd be great if we could say, yeah, there is a way to get out of life, but there isn't from what we're hearing. And so we actually tried to get all the... When we talk about channeled messages, I don't know if your audience really knows what channeling is. It's where you have a psychic medium, often referred to as a channel, who gets mind-to-mind information from a spirit or somebody who doesn't have a body now. And so we were looking at communications that came from people who claim to have killed themselves successfully. So it's a little bit different from just near-death experiences where they almost kill themselves but don't quite make it. They have that point of no return where they realize they've left the body and can't come back.
Didn't have the guts to go all the way. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
No. I tell you what, it's interesting how often the second they realize they succeeded, they change their mind and they regretted it. It's really kind of sad to read.
Well, you know, that happens to a lot of us in many situations in life, that when we finally go through with something, then we're like, you know what, I shouldn't have done that. mm-hmm. and you feel really bad about it, and that guilt sets in. Catholic Church loves guilt. Let me tell you, they love some guilt. Oh, yeah. That's why I opted for Episcopalianism a long time ago. It's all the fun of Catholicism with none of the guilt. I'm telling you. Anyway, I'm going to get crucified tonight. No.
Well, you didn't want to look at it from a religious standpoint, per se, so much as a very practical one.
Yeah.
Do people get what they want? You know, because if people get what they want, then, you know,
then it's okay.
The solution. But in almost every case that we looked at, and I'm going to make an exception here for assisted suicides with people who have terminal illnesses. Okay, that's a different group. But for traditional suicides who have a healthy body and they take their own life, and none of them really got what they wanted. You know, in every single case, they came back pretty much with regrets, and they realized there was something about it that they really regretted. And it might have been who found their body. It might have been that, like I say, the second they finished, they realized, you know, oh, gee, I thought I was going to not have any more consciousness. I was going to be, you know, dead, and there was nothing in the afterlife. And they realized, guess what? You take all your psychological baggage with you, and you're still conscious. You're still aware of yourself. So if you were depressed before, you're still depressed.
Well, you know, and you hear so many stories about in the newspapers, and I know people that have, you know, committed suicide, and I'm sure we all do or know of someone or somebody that knows somebody that's done it, and we all hear these stories about how the body was found and what it did to the family members that were involved, and it's just a really sad thing.
It devastates everybody, and when I say everybody, I mean even the person who killed themselves, because they apparently can feel the emotions of those still living. You know, just like when you die, you don't lose that connection. If you love someone, you know, you still love someone.
Now what do you say to these people that say, hey, you know what, to quote Ozzy Osbourne, no, I'm not going to do that, the suicide solution song, but to the whole idea behind the Ozzy Osbourne suicide solution, that whole idea behind the song, and the whole idea behind just the actual idea of it being a solution and it being an escape from the pain and the angst and the suffering that they're going through. What do you tell people that think that's the truth and it is an escape for that and an end to feeling a ceaseless sleep, for example?
Well, certainly if we believe what we're being told, they say very clearly it's not a solution. You don't escape your problems. If anything, it makes them worse.
Okay, and can you give us some examples of that?
In some cases, for example, people will commit suicide, say, I'll give you a better one.
Okay.
Loneliness. People are really, really lonely. It's an incredibly painful place to be, and I think it leads to a lot of suicides, especially around Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
But when you die, you take all of your psychological baggage with you. You're still conscious, you're still aware, and you're still just as incredibly lonely. Only now, because you're dead, the people who might have loved you or cared about you or reached out to you, they can't see you. They're not. You're even more lonely. You're even more cut off than you were before.
Now, who are you, these channeled conversations with the dead? Who initiated these?
Well, it varies. A lot of times we went from, these are books where a parent channeled their child who committed suicide, and they're sort of one-off books. In other cases, they're professionals like James Van Praagh or John Edward, who works as a psychic medium.
Oh, John Edward, we know about him.
Yeah.
Messages on. But these messages come back, you can even go back to Allan Kardec in the 1700s. And get a lot of messages about suicides. So what we looked at is we tried to gather everything we could find, pretty much within reason. After a while, our editor was like, quit, you got too much stuff.
It is a thick book.
but, you know, we tried to gather everything we could find and then look for common themes and common patterns and common ground to say, okay, this looks like it's not just a single person saying this. Everybody's saying this is what happens. You go through your life review, you do your self-judgment, you do your spiritual work, and that kind of stuff. So we looked at experiences in the afterlife. We looked at messages to those left behind. We looked at messages to people who want to kill themselves. And we gave each of these, you know, different chapters. So if you are interested in the book, you don't have to be intimidated by the size. You can just flip straight to the chapter that interests you most.
Now, there's a lot of stuff in here, especially dealing with suicide bombers, things of that nature. We'll get into that a little later. I think that was one of the points that interested me in the book, though. Some of the conversations with those purported conversations with those people. I have to say purported because, you know, I just don't buy a lot of this stuff.
Well, and you can. And, in fact, at the start of the book, we talk about the fact that we don't know for a fact that each and every one of these is who or what they claim to be. And we talk about the pitfalls of channeled material. However, if we were to go purported and said to be every single time we said something, it would just get so unwieldy, nobody would want to read the book.
I have another 40 pages at least. But I'm just wondering. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I just think it'd probably double it, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm just wondering, though. I mean, how many of these, you know, where do you draw that empirical line at, and where do you say, okay, well, this is... We kind of believe that this is real, what this story this person's telling us, and we kind of don't believe this person over here. Where's the line that you draw on gathering this kind of empirical data?
Well, to a certain extent, we looked for ways we could try to corroborate it. So just like if you were a cop and you were trying to figure out what happened during a robbery, you'd ask all the witnesses. And then you look for common ground. And you look, where does everybody say the same thing? And where is one person so off the wall that it's, you know, probably, you know, within their imagination? And that's what we did, too. We looked for common ground. We also looked for other ways of getting this information. For example, we looked at near-death experiences, people who tried to kill themselves, had a near-death experience, but were successfully resuscitated. And their experiences were, to a point, pretty similar to the experiences that we were being told about from the channeled messages. We're like, okay, this is someone who's claiming that they've had the same experience that other people are channeling, so it sort of gives the channeling a little extra weight. We also looked at reincarnation research data. So where we could, we tried to find other ways that we could sort of cross-corroborate or you know, figure out, is this really true or not?
Now, you know, what... I hate to play devil. Well, actually, I love to play devil's advocate, so I'm not gonna
no
lie.
Lies, guys.
That law background, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, the next question is this: do you think that maybe this is a big ploy, a big scam designed by the psychic community? I'm going to call them the psychic community and generalize that just for now. But do you think that this may be a big scam, a big ploy designed by the psychic community to send out a message of suicide is bad, you shouldn't do it because it doesn't benefit society as a whole, and we're telling you not to do it because, you know, it's going to make it, all it's doing is, well, God, I'm trying to organize my question here, and it's turning itself around.
I understand what you're saying.
But yeah, do you think maybe that you know, it's kind of like they say, the funeral's not for the dead, it's for the living. Do you think that maybe this is a ploy designed to stop the number of suicides, to send a strong, pure, good public message about psychics, where in the past they've had a bad public message spread about them?
You'd be talking about organizing psychics who are not known for really working well together over 300 years in countries around the world.
Okay.
So we're getting the same messages, say, from Japan or from China or from Holland as we are from the United States. And some of these countries are countries where the cultures actually accept suicide fairly well, and yet they're giving similar messages.
So I guess the the ancient Greek what is it, Chuck? Is it Timae? Is that it? The honor thing? What is it? Do you remember?
I'm not familiar.
Arete? Is it Arete? Timae? It's one of those old words where, you know, that you kill yourself because of the lack of honor.
Yeah, and we looked at those cultures too, and yet they were coming up with very similar messages. Now there is some cultural variation, and we point out sometimes if something that's being said is shall we say, on the edge of the bell curve, you know, a little bit less on the common way. And it doesn't mean necessarily it's wrong, but it may not be right, and we don't know. We'll add cautions in when we get material like that. And if somebody was too off the wall, I have to admit they did not get included in the book.
Okay, give us an example. I have to hear this.
Oh, there's a guy who claimed to channel Shakespeare, for example, who was talking about the women actresses, and anyone who knows anything about history knows that men played the women's parts. So,
yeah, very true.
It was clearly so historically inaccurate that I could not believe it was Shakespeare talking, okay?
What if it was a big conspiracy by the Shakespeare people, though, that rewrote? No, I'm sorry.
It was poorly written. I don't think it was the bard. So those kinds of things. I mean, if something you read it, you're just like, you know, this is just, I'm not buying this. I'm not buying this cigar. But if it's interesting how often these reports are so similar. It really was not hard to find common ground at all. There were some minor variations. There are some differences in experiences. We do, to a certain extent, create our own realities, both in this world and even more so when we cross to the other side. So not everybody, you know, has the exact same experience, and I don't want to imply to your audience that, you know, it's a cookie stamp experience. There are some variations, but they're the kind of variations you would expect that different personalities would have.
So I want you to walk us through I want you to walk us through, though, if you can, like a generalized, you know, what happens when you die, kind of suicide, you know, from the first step to that next realization level. But first, let me give the numbers here. If you want to call in and speak with Dr. Heath, or you can, I guess you can call her Pam. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. If you want to call in and speak with Pam, the number here is 1-877-SCARE-U2. That's 1-877-722-7382. Or you can call us locally, 336-996-1596. Both of those numbers are on our website at www.worldoftheunexplained.com. And you can just call right in and we'll plug you right in through. So right now, though, if you would go ahead and kind of walk us through what happens. Like, let's say this person just slit their wrist and they're beginning
right
to die.
One of two things can happen. First being that they don't realize they're dead. And this is especially a problem if they're a skeptic and they were convinced there was no afterlife. Because since they still are conscious and they feel like they still have a body, they'll keep trying to kill themselves.
Okay.
And it can be a pretty sad situation.
Wow.
Where you'll see someone slashing at their wrist over and over and over again, trying to kill themselves because they keep thinking they must have failed somehow, when in fact they succeeded. There are always spirit guides, we're told, to greet people on the other side. However, because you no longer have a body, you no longer have eyes or ears. So the only way you have to perceive that you have greeters around them is if you're willing to be open to that idea, if you're willing to perceive it. And so some of these people will actually not be able to recognize or see their spirit guides until somebody who's living, since they're willing to see people who are still solid and living, says, hey, look for this person. So that's where spirit mediums can sometimes sort of help these people move on.
Okay.
Fortunately, a lot of these people can see their greeters, and these greeters sort of try and orient them to the fact they're dead and help them move on and complete their transition to the afterlife. Now, for the average suicide, you will spend a time doing self-life review and self-judgment, which is you kind of go back through your life, and it's done more than once, and you look at how your life affected everybody and everyone around you. However, even while you're doing that, you're still connected to those you left behind. And if people are thinking about you or feeling angry or sad, these people will be aware of that. They're also aware of if you're praying for them. So there's sort of a plus-minus to that. But they're going to do their life review and self-judgment. Once they have finished going through that under the supervision of a spirit guide, so that they're neither too harsh nor too easy on themselves, then they will move on to a phase of doing spiritual work. And a lot of these people will decide to become greeters and greet other newly dead suicides, since, you know, they know what it's like to be there.
So heaven's a little like Walmart then, huh?
Yeah, I guess.
Good one, Chuck.
So. How about that? Yeah, the older, wiser heads can often be good greeters. But then some of them, if you believe in reincarnation, will then choose to reincarnate. And that's one of the problems suicides get into, is that usually they have to face all of the problems that they had in their life made worse.
You mean if they choose to reincarnate?
Yeah, but there. It sounds like, again, and not everyone believes in reincarnation. I do. But
I don't, but that's okay. We'll go with this.
Read Ian Stevenson. You may change your mind. It's interesting because they're certainly strongly encouraged to do it, and in fact, there's some implication that with suicides, they kind of toss them back into life a little quicker because they really want them to face what they were trying to run away from.
Face it and overcome it to make them stronger people.
Yeah, to make them better. They pick these, I mean, we're told that there are reasons for what we face in life, and we're told that we have what we need to overcome them. We're also told if we ask for help, it'll always be there. So, you know, they really emphasize that we're supposed to, you know, take this class and learn our lessons, or we'll have to come back and repeat the grade.
Now, you know, I generally go off on people on these spirit guides. It's because I have an issue with them. I have an issue with reincarnation for exactly the same reason.
Okay.
And that's just basically, you know, and not always. And I'm gonna preface this by saying not always is this the case, but more times than not, what you hear when you hear people talk about reincarnation and spirit guides and things like that. Here's an example I'll use for the spirit guide. You know, oh, well, my spirit guide's name is, Theodos, whatever, the third, and he was an aristocrat back in 1800 and, you know, whatever, in England, and he was also like the, a mystery to the, you know, so-and-so royal family that did this, this, and this, you know, or, you know, I was Napoleon or Elvis Presley.
Well,
in the past.
That was what I was just about to say.
Yeah,
actually. Yeah.
You hear both of those tales. Though. You never hear somebody say, you know what, I was a slave back in North Carolina in 1812, and my life sucked. Okay, you know, you never.
I've heard people say that, actually.
Well, yeah, I mean, you hear it every now and then. What I'm saying is the majority of the stuff that you do hear.
Right, it's a question of are you there for ego, but,
yeah.
I mean, we could get into the whole past life thing. I've got a little article about it on my website at www.pamelaheath.com.
Yeah, I was getting ready to say go ahead and plug that. It's www.pamelaheath.com.
I would say if you're on the fence about reincarnation, to start with Ian Stevenson's book, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation, because he's done some very interesting research. And I've run into, if you talk to a lot of parents who have children under the age of 5, usually they'll have these past life memories about age 3,
mm-hmm.
and they may come up with specific details that you can verify, even be able to speak complete other languages.
I buy that.
Been exposed to and stuff like that, so it can be very interesting stuff.
You buy what, reincarnation or?
Well, no. That past life regression and that at such a young age that maybe they're.
You can tune into
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, you know, there's a book out there, and I don't know if you're familiar with this doctor. There's a book out there by I cannot remember her name. I think it's called Ghost. Is this striking any chords with you?
Nah.
Damn. All right, I'm gonna have to look for that. It's in my car. Maybe I can run out to it on the break. We're gonna have to take one here in a little bit anyway. But I'm gonna try to run out there and grab it. It's actually on audio CD. It's not a book because I used to drive a lot, you know, from Florida to North Carolina a lot, and so I'd have to have something to listen to. And this was actually I talked to Dr. Ryan Feather about this from the Ryan Research Center. And she had read the book. She was familiar with it. I'm sure you'll know it as soon as I bring it up. But she talks about some of these same things happening in India with these children that are able to speak
right.
these other languages. And it's just, it's amazing.
Right.
So maybe that is, you know, maybe that does point to something like that.
Yeah, but that's not the focus of our book. Our book really is to look at what spirits supposedly say, you know, who have killed themselves, about what their experience is like in the afterlife, how they feel about their situation now, and, you know, what they want people on our side in the physical plane to know. And some of them claim that the reason they're passing these messages back is it's a part of their spiritual work. It's sort of a self-imposed penance, is to try to make sure other people don't follow in their footsteps and make the same mistakes they made.
Well, and that's valid. That's a valid argument. You know, I want to get into the religiosity of this here after the break. But right now, we're going to take a break. If you'll hang tight with us, we'll be right back here on World of the Unexplained. And come on in, guys. I'm sorry. I apologize. I wasn't in the chat room when the show started. Hopefully, you guys will hang around in there. and I'll be coming in there after the break as well. But we're here with Dr. Pamela Heath. The book is Suicide, Channel Conversations. You know, don't you hate it when you drop the book there and you think you know the title? All right. The book is Suicide, What Really Happens to Us in the Afterlife, Channel Conversations with the Dead. And we're going to have John Klimo on next hour as well. Stick around. We'll be back. World of the Unexplained after this. And we're back. And you're listening to us here live, World of the Unexplained. We want to thank, once again, Planet Paranormal, our new network that we're with tonight for carrying us. We like them. They like us, apparently, we hope. we're back here with Dr. Pamela Heath, and we're talking about suicide. So if you guys have any questions about suicide, give us a shout here, 336-996-1596, or toll-free at 877-722-7382 for those of you that can't remember that kind of stuff. 877 scare you too. I love that. I picked that out myself. It was hard to find.
That was a very good choice.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought it was. Okay, Pam. So let's talk some more about this. Pam.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Making sure you were there. Scared me there for a little bit. All right. So we go through this, and we've got the spirit guide and or the greeter, whatever you want to call that person,
right.
And they lead them through. Now, what happens to somebody in a normal death situation? Did you get any conversations back on this?
Basically the same. Yeah, that's one of the interesting things about this is that no matter how you die, maybe with the exception of, you know, death by explosion, people seem to go through very much the same stages. The difference is if you die in a normal way at the end of life, you're expecting to die. You know, you're looking for your greeters. There's not the trouble of connecting as much with the people who are trying to help you make your transition. People who die from sudden unexpected accidents or who are died by violence, say by murder, those people can, like the suicides, also be kind of confused about whether they're dead and have a little bit of trouble. But again, everybody seems to go through the same stages. It's just a matter of whether you go through them quickly and easily or seem to have more trouble dealing with them.
Okay. I was looking at Chuck. I thought he wanted to say something.
I kicked the mic.
So what you know, what I'm going to take this in a whole different place, Pam.
Sure.
What do you think about demonic possession?
Yeah, that was a U-turn, man.
Psychologist. It's interesting because we do talk about possession in this book, and some of the older people, especially Carl Wicklund, for example, who is a psychiatrist in the early 1900s, believe strongly in possession, and there are some cultures, such as in the Philippines, that still strongly believe in possession. I would say it's very rare. I have only run into a few people who either claim to have been at least briefly possessed or who appeared to have a spirit attached to them that was negative, shall we say. But in those cases, it was always voluntary. In other words, they had either invited the spirit in unwittingly, doing the Ouija board or something, or they had literally thought that this spirit was going to give them power, so, you know, come on in, take me over. And I've never seen it where it was really unwilling. Most of the so-called possessions I've seen footage of or heard about, the people are possessed by their own inner demons. There's no outside spirit involved.
Okay, so you don't believe in any malevolent spirits floating around there just trying to jump in?
There are a few.
Where do these...
Few. I don't think they're common.
Where do they come from?
Well, the ones I've run into were mostly human beings. You know, you don't change personality instantly just because you're dead. If you're smart, you stay smart. If you're dumb, you stay dumb. And if you're nasty, you stay nasty.
I'm still going to be a jerk when I die.
You've gone through your life review and self-judgment. That's where people start to shift. And it's after that you'll see some spirits come back and ask for forgiveness.
Okay.
And things like that. But not until they've done their life review and self-judgment. So if a spirit hangs around and refuses to finish their transition or go into the afterlife or do their stuff, they're going to have the same personality, basically, they had when they were alive. And if it was unpleasant when they were alive, it'll be unpleasant when they're dead.
We got a caller that just called in. And before we take the call, I want to say that I did want to ask you about these greeters and this life review, because you said that the greeters would sit with the person and, you know, maybe sometime they would be too harsh on them, or they would be too, you know, make sure they weren't too harsh on themselves or too lenient. and the converse. And
we're all our own worst judgment, you know, judges. I mean, we're all usually harder on ourselves than we ought to be. So they'll sometimes point out, oh, look at this, you did this really good thing for somebody here. You know, they'll try and bring balance to the situation. On the other hand, for example, with the suicide bombers who tend to have no regrets, they can't just blow through their life review and self-judgment and say, oh, no problem that I killed all these people and left all their families, you know, in pain and anguish, you know.
Or they're still pissed off. Where are my 70 virgins? Right? Okay. All right, let's go to the call.
All right, man.
All right. Caller, you're on the air. It's World of the Unexplained. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
70 virgins. Wow, this is an interesting
call. Oh, this must be Scott from Omaha.
It sure is.
How's it going, buddy?
Hey, not bad. Great show, as usual.
Thank you.
A question I have for your guest is there any notion that that there could be any sort of predisposition to suicide, maybe that's passed down genetically? I know in some cases that sounds kind of self-limiting, but I suppose someone could get to a certain age, have children, and then commit suicide. Is there any research that suggests that maybe that is passed down through the genes?
Hmm.
I would say only indirectly, in the sense that when you have mental illness, such as manic depressive illness, which does have a genetic component, certain other medical conditions have a genetic component, and that can be associated with increased risk for suicide. So it's sort of an indirect thing rather than direct. However, I would say this. One of the things that came up in the past life reincarnation research was that there does seem to be increased incidence of repeating suicide and of being suicidal in this lifetime if you had suicidal previous lifetimes.
Hmm. Scott?
Great. That's very interesting. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Question.
Appreciate it. Okay, I've got another question for you, Pam. It's on from our chat room. They said that they can't call in, but they wanted to ask you about the movie The Bridge coming out next week about suicide on the Golden Gate Bridge and how we as a society overprotect our people from murder, terrorist acts, etc., and fail to see a problem with suicide. I'm not familiar with the film.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either. But we do look a little bit at some of the Golden Gate Bridge research because those people have had some very interesting experiences. Many of them like seeing a door open, and it's like they're stepping through the door. It's almost a mystical type of experience if they survive it and later talk about it.
Wow.
And what I would say is I know we're talking about, I'm out in the Bay Area, so we are talking seriously about putting suicide prevention barriers up. But you cannot prevent somebody from committing suicide if they really want to do it. And it doesn't matter if you're going to choose to end your life in a beautiful location like the Golden Gate Bridge or quietly in your bathroom at home. It doesn't really matter. You can't really stop people if they're determined to do it. What you can do, however, which is what I'm trying to do with this book, is make sure they understand what they're getting into. Let them understand, is this really going to give them what they want? I mean, just not from a religious standpoint, but just from a practical standpoint. Are they going to get what they want if they do this? And if they do insist on doing it anyway, let them at least understand what to sort of be watching out for, what to expect. Maybe it will help them have a smoother transition and an easier time in the afterlife.
Okay. And let's go back to this greeter situation, though. So suppose that I am a terrorist bomber and I kill myself.
Yeah.
And I show up and I'm like, okay, you know, let's pass on the, okay, I've seen the life and review thing. Okay, boring, let's move on. What happens? What does the greeter do to make me feel remorse?
Ah, well, it's not their job to make you feel anything. But what they will do is you will have to literally walk in the shoes. You'll have to live as if it was you. We're the victim, okay? So for every person you hurt,
wow,
you have to live out their life, their experience, and then
die.
To live out the experience of every single person whose life was touched by that. And you don't do it just once.
What if you're still
do it several times?
What if you're still a mean SOB when all that's said and done?
They keep you isolated. You know, that was one of sort of the interesting things. They especially keep the bomb makers isolated from the bombers themselves because they feel like the bomb makers are really manipulative people. And they actually keep them sort of isolated from other people and from the afterlife a bit, more than the usual. They do it a little bit for everybody, but much more so for the suicide bombers.
Hmm.
And they sort of try to sort of teach them gradually, but from what they're saying, these people really have incredibly slow transitions. They may take 1,000 years to go through their life review.
So back to past life regression, how does that relate to the terrorists? Were they terrorists in their previous lives or murderers? Or
we didn't look at that, but it's interesting that suicide murder actually goes back 2,000 years, since some of the original documented ones were Jewish, and they were trying to win freedom from Rome.
Oh,
so it has been used for a long time as a tool, a political tool.
Oh, we've got another caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Phyllis from Chicago.
Hi, Phyllis. How are you?
Hey, welcome.
Hi, Bear. It's cold here.
It's cold here.
I have cousins in Chicago. It's a cold and windy city.
Oh, yeah. I kind of wanted to go back to, the religious aspect.
Sure.
of this issue. And not to sound awful, but, I was raised a Catholic. Mm-hmm. And, from a very small age, we're told suicides just go straight to hell.
Mm-hmm.
I personally do not believe that, okay? I think that, God is merciful and, he would look at your situation and your state of mind. That being said, we go to the other side of the coin, and I know, J. Scott had mentioned something about demonic possession.
Mm-hmm.
And would that have something to do with, someone being brought to that brink? You kind of said, well, it would be very rare. But from the paranormal and spiritual perspective, do you think that someone could be oppressed enough to get to that point?
Yeah, I have to say, I wondered about that guy who lived in a haunted house for many years.
Mm-hmm.
He then went into that school. Whether there might have been a little bit of influence there from something. There's no way to know. But I have to say, I did wonder about that. It is something that's been discussed.
I
think if you are vulnerable through mental illness or tiredness, exhaustion, other things can do it.
Right.
I think you can certainly be influenced. And we do talk in this book that, for example, some spirits will hang out around alcoholics or drug addicts as a way of getting vicariously high and encourage them to indulge.
And I've read that in other books, specifically, books by Ed and Lorraine Warren, where they talk about like attracts like. If you are
Pam, I'm sorry, Phyllis, are you familiar with the you mentioned Ed and Lorraine Warren? Are you familiar with the Amityville Horror and the Ronald DeFeo and all that?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they really mentioned this in the book The Demonologist. They're talking about your spiritual disposition. If you're a negative person, or if you're going through some kind of depression, or if you've got very negative habits, then you can actually attract very negative spirits to you, and they can start some sort of oppression that would eventually drive you to that point if you don't get help. I know you said you're not really sure, but would you tend to at least agree with that basic?
I do tend to agree with the Warren, and I think that's as tactful as I can put it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I am going to say I believe that there is a great deal more free choice and free will.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that some of the spirits that were channeled initially claimed to have committed suicide purely because of possession.
Mm-hmm.
And later recanted, and they said, well, actually, no, that wasn't really true. I just didn't want to take responsibility for how I felt.
Right.
So it's hard to say, but I tend to be fairly skeptical about that because we're all here in life with the resources we need, you know, although we may not see them. And,
right.
And whether those be, we're told at least, that there's always spirit guides around us that if we ask them for help, they'll help us.
Right,
and things
right.
like that.
That and it's...
I don't think that spirit can take over unless there's a part of you that's asking for it or willing.
Right. Yeah, and I do agree with that. I totally believe that, you know, we're given free will for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a tough subject to deal with to begin with. You know, I was mentioning in the chat room that, you know, there are two ways that you can look at it, just, you know, from the perspective of just being a human being. On the one hand, you want to feel just so sorry for these people that, you know, they're driven to this point of such desperation. And then on the other hand, you know, you just want to, if you could, I would just shake them and say, what were you thinking? You know, how could you be so selfish?
Well, a lot of times they aren't thinking is the problem.
Right.
They're feeling. They're in great pain. They're great emotional pain.
Right.
Or they're angry. Some of them may be on drugs or drunk. And there's a lot of different things that combine together to tip you over the edge.
Right.
And I guess the problem is if you could get them sometimes to just wait one more minute or one more day,
exactly.
things would change for them. And I'm kind of hoping that if people read this book, and especially that chapter, From Suicides to the Suicidal, that
mm-hmm.
they'll understand that maybe it's worth hanging in there just a little bit longer to see if things change.
Right.
Did you hear that
right.
noise?
Well, thanks for letting me call in.
All right. Thanks, Phyllis.
Great show. Thanks.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Did you hear that noise?
Yeah,
it sounded like
I
an
did.
Airplane or something. Did you hear that, Pam?
Nah.
That's on our end. That was creepy. Okay. All right. Ooh. Yeah. And now that we're the only two that heard it. Okay. Never mind.
It was bleed from the guys listening in at Quantico.
Yeah, probably. Our government friends.
Yeah.
So, wow. Okay. We were talking about the greeters. And we were talking about. I want to make another note, though, that well, some of our listeners heard it. Apparently, yes, it was an airplane. Oh, okay, that came from Chicago. one of the things that I wanted to say was, you know, I wanted to mention that Ed Warren has passed away, and I wanted to send out the condolences to those mm-hmm. people. It was a few months ago, but Lorraine is still alive and kicking. Lorraine's a great lady. I've known her for a number of years. She's a psychic and. A very religious, very Roman Catholic person, real sweet lady. But anyway, regardless of that, going back to suicide. Chuck, you got anything?
Well, you were asking about the greeters. One of the things that's sort of interesting is they can, spirits, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about ghosts or spirit guides, can appear however they want to appear. And so spirit guides will sometimes appear as people that they feel that we'll accept, because we're more apt to see them, to perceive them.
So
if we're someone that we're expecting or that we accept. So for like the suicide bombers, they would sometimes appear to be a virgin greeting them.
Oh my God.
Or a holy man greeting them, just to try to get them to finish their transition.
So if I, as a Christian, die, I'm going to see Christ, but it's actually a greeter dressed up.
Or you might see Gabriel with his horn. I mean, there are actually some channeled messages by Arthur Ford and others that say, yeah, with fundamentalist Christians who are convinced that, you know, they're going to see angels with wings and golden harps and all this stuff, they'll literally create that for them.
Now... I'm going to come to another hardball question for you.
Sure.
And this is right before the top of the hour. and then we're going to bring John on
uh-huh.
with you, hopefully, if that's okay. and the hardball question is this. How do you know that these people that... And I know we talked that you said you were a psychic. We talked about that off the air. How do you know, though, that these people that you feel... That these people that you talk to, that you communicate with, that supposedly are communicating with these people in the afterlife, how do you know that these things that you're communicating with aren't demons? and they're telling you something to dissuade you and move you away.
Well, it can be far more simple than demons. It could be coming from their own unconscious.
Or, yeah, just
from their own belief systems. I mean, we don't have to get involved with the whole demon question. There's no way to know for sure.
Okay.
You have to look and see, is there, like I say, common ground, or is this something totally off the wall? Is this something where there's some support for it? There was something that did not get into the book, simply because when I was talking to the psychic, we were doing it informally, and she told me about something that was so off the wall, I was like, there is no way this could be true. And I really thought she was way out there, you know, that being a New Yorker, the 9/11 stuff had been too much for her, you know, and she just had gone off the wall with this. And I was later reading in the Islamic Book of the Dead, and darned if what she told me might not be the case. But I wasn't able to get it formally. So you don't know. Sometimes you're talking to someone and you're thinking, or there was Joanna Carroll, for example, was another person who actually was in the book. She's from Sedona, and she channeled one of the terrorists, and he was saying an Arabic prayer. She was trying to sound it out for us. And neither of us had a clue what she was saying, you know, but I wrote it down phonetically as best I could. Again, going back to the Islamic Book of the Dead, that's one of the prayers the dead say, a piece of it.
Yeah, well,
and I was like, wow, maybe she really was in contact with something.
I guess my question...
Neither of us knew what it was.
My question is, if it's truly demonic activity that's going on, I mean, these demons are going to know everything from creation to now, and they're going to be able to manipulate and play on these things. I mean, how do you know?
I'm not a big believer on any demons other than the inner demons we all have. You know, speaking as a psychologist.
That's too new age of an answer for me, Pam.
The poltergeist phenomena where I run into people being attacked by things, it's coming from their own unconscious. It's mind over matter.
They like attacking those prepubescent girls, don't they?
Well, you know, they have issues. I mean, if you read any of the books about poltergeist, or if you read the PK Zone, it's very clear that some of these people have been psychologically set up for this, and they have a lot of stress, and there's reasons. You can look at what happens to them as being a perfect metaphor from the unconscious, just like if you were looking at a dream.
Well, why do you think that it affects prepubescent girls more than any other group of people on average?
Oh, well, there's all kinds of personality tests that talk about that.
Okay.
We don't need to get into
that. All right, too much detail.
Yeah, well,
some men like to affect prepubescent girls, too. That's why there's laws.
I'm not sure you're in as to what group it is. There are some cultures where it's the boys, not the girls.
That must be Greek. No, I'm kidding.
I mean, that's a cultural thing.
Yeah.
And there's cultural influence in that.
Fire Island. I'm kidding. They're lost.
But I have only run into, and I don't talk about being psychic that much. I have been psychic for a number of years. I've only run into a handful of what I would call truly evil spirits. And there was, of those, only one that I felt like might have never incarnated.
Okay.
Which would be, I don't know, would that be what you'd call a demon? I don't know. But most of them are people who are very evil in life, and they're evil in death.
So Hitler would be a good example of that.
Hitler's interesting. He's never been channeled by anybody that I could find or anyone's known.
You just haven't met the right people, Pam.
That we didn't get into is that... during this transition phase, if you were very ill for a while before you died, or if you died by explosion, there may be a period of long period of time where your body sort of recovers, and you may be sort of either in sleeping or sort of a coma type state of consciousness, or you may actually sort of see yourself as being in a hospital. And then every time you start to get upset, you know, you go back to sleep, and you sleep for a while, and then you wake back up, and, you know, they're checking you over, and you go back to sleep. So there do seem to be recovery phases for some groups of people that will occur before you get to the life review and self-judgment.
All right, well, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to be right back with Dr. Pamela Heath and Dr. John Klimo. You're listening to World of the Unexplained on the Planet Paranormal Network. And we're back on World of the Unexplained. We've got with us now, joining Dr. Pamela Heath, Dr. John Klimo, Ph.D., is Associate Professor of Psychology at American Schools of Professional Psychology at Argosy University. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Argosy
University in California. He's the author of Channeling, Investigations on Receiving Information from Paranormal Sources, first published in 1987 and expanded into a new edition published by North Atlantic Books in 1998. So, Dr. Klimo, welcome to World of the Unexplained.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. And Dr. Heath, are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay, great. Now, can I call you John?
Sure, please.
All right. John and Pam, or do you prefer Pam or Pamela?
Pam.
Okay. John and Pam. All right. John, what did you think was the most difficult part of putting this book together?
Most difficult part. I think it was yet again addressing a prospective reading audience with regard to the unknown or the unresolved quality about, do we really survive physical death? What evidence really is there? And or can we just proceed with leaving the jury staying out about that, that it's unresolved, but go on and look at these purported messages from spirit realm and from the spirits of purported suicides, and just work with that without getting all caught up in probably the unanswerable issue of, well, is that really from beyond the grave, or is that from wishful thinking or from people's unconscious or whatever? That's always hard to deal with that. So in the part of the book where we try to address that, that's a never-ending issue, because some people want it resolved one way or the other. They don't believe there's any survival of death. They believe everything about what they hear about it, and it's kind of a mixed bag. So that's always a problem for me.
Okay. Pam, what about you?
I really enjoyed doing the research for this book and going through all the channeled material and organizing it. So I would say the hardest part is trying to find a very easy style of language that communicates our compassion and our caring, and the fact that we're not telling people don't commit suicide because we're being mean or we don't care about the pain they're in. We do care. It's just it doesn't appear to be a solution, and that we don't want people to find themselves in this situation where they're in a lot of pain and they try to use suicide as an out, and then they realize they've only made things worse for themselves.
Now, Dr. Klimo, are you a psychic, or do you consider yourself a psychic?
I would prefer to classify myself as strongly intuitive.
Okay.
Good answer.
Then you're not going to get me to guess cards or something at the drop of a hat.
Oh, come on.
I'm strongly intuitive, yeah.
Our guests take all the fun from us, man. They do every time. Yeah. Every time. Spoils my fun. No.
Hey, always leave an opening.
What did Pam say? Did you ask her that?
Yeah. She said she's a psychic.
That's right. She'll say it right flat-footedly, yeah.
I asked her if I was going to pass the next bar exam, and she said yes. I'm wondering what your intuitive thoughts are on this.
Well, you know, to me, to really do justice to my intuitive capacities, I'd have to probably go to a similar place inside myself that somebody who considers himself more flat-out psychic would go to make myself very quiet, receptive, open, and ask for guidance, and that I be as accurate as possible on behalf of the other person. And then I don't know whether you call yourself an intuitive or a psychic, whether it much matters. It's probably a similar process.
So he's not going to answer the question. Okay.
About the bar exam?
Yeah.
I'd have to make myself so quiet there'd be too much dead air time on the radio. You wouldn't want it.
Okay. That's fine. All joking aside, though. But, okay, so you do consider yourself somewhat psychic. We're just going to use a layman term here and throw it around.
Okay, yeah. Because I'm so open to the realm of the psychic and the unusual and alternative modes of getting information and guidance and so on, I walk my talk. I practice that myself. But I don't, like, put a shingle out and kind of, you know, advertise it, so to speak. I'd rather focus on other things. But, you know, Jay, there was one thing you asked earlier about what was difficult about this. I would say in this book, in hindsight, I would say true what I said earlier, but the other part is about the last third of the book that deals with the suicide bombers. Uh-huh. And the whole Middle Eastern, socio-political, economic context, essentially the socio-political one, and the spiritual one, that the difficulty was in not falling prey to vilifying and demonizing the suicide bombers as if the only perspective we should have is the Bush administration's perspective or something like that. In other words, to really empathize with what drove them to these extents that they'd kill themselves and in the process of killing others, to really sort of walk in their shoes and hear from their own what led them to this.
Drove them is because they practice a religion of hate. I mean, it's I'm gonna play the Michael Savage devil's advocate right now, but I mean that's really what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with people that hate our way of life, that hate us, and I'm not gonna make excuses because we have a capitalistic society that has, you know, you work hard and you achieve things and you're proud of those, and you know, we believe in God here. Well, not all of us, but a good majority of us down here in the good old South. And there's certain values that we believe in, and they just don't have the same value. They don't place the same kind of value that we do on human life. And when you get to, you know, when you lack that kind of humanity, you know, and don't get me wrong, I used to be a liberal until my eyes were open, but you know, the problem here is that, you know, you can't just constantly apologize for something that we didn't cause this. You know, they caused this out of their own hatred. They caused this out of their own non-tolerance.
Well, we're not completely
certain,
not at fault.
There's a certain history, a certain foreign
affairs. I do hate Bush,
history,
though, by the way.
The American administration over the past few administrations has done some contributing to the end of the rope. A state that some of these terrorists have gotten into, that they feel the only way they can express what they had to express is, unfortunately, in an extreme way that I do not support. Certainly, I don't support. Sure, they can't value life the way they do if they're willing to explode bodies all over the place. I'm not trying to defend that. I'm just saying that there is a history to the Middle Eastern situation, so that if you really openly read the whole thing, you'd see, well, there is some, I can sort of see some of the grounds from which they would come, that they'd be so extremely frustrated, so extremely exasperated, and then you could say, well, that moves to hate. I don't know if it moves to hate or just last resort, I'll use my body as a weapon, that's all I've got left, because talking doesn't work, nothing else works, we're being ganged up on by these bigger powers.
I'm not saying that. I'm just saying in society in general, it seems that we're moving to that more. We're living in a society now where we're open to everything, we're tolerant of everything, and that's only going to spell destruction down the road.
Well, I would just say that one thing that surprised me in doing this book is that suicide bombers are more like traditional suicides than you would think, and it's that they feel disenfranchised, they feel othered, and a lot of them feel they have no choice. They are basically truly without hope. And so they're very much like traditional suicides in that, and it's just something to sort of keep in mind.
Yeah, I'm not saying, and I know what these people are thinking when they go through with these attacks. I mean, obviously, you can probably link them draw some kind of analogy to the kamikaze war pilots in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, go ahead, Chuck. You look like you had something you wanted to say there, and I kind of.
I was just thinking that we shouldn't let the United States completely off and, you know, blameless in this whole situation. We have used
I hate President Bush.
The entire Middle East, though, at least for the last 40 or 60 years, is a, you know, way station or service station, and, you know, allowed despots to rule there so that we could use it in that capacity. No,
I agree. I didn't vote for Bush. I voted for John Kerry. I did. And, you know, I was in Florida too. I was in a swing state, and I was, you know, I had this John Kerry. I've never put any kind of political affiliation outside of my lawn. I had this in front of my house, and the sign got knocked down, and this lady jogger was coming by one morning. I think I just woke up with a severe hangover the night before. I looked outside my window, though. This thing was knocked down in the lawn, and she picked the thing up and put it back on the post. I was like, my God, that tells you something right there. You know, about how rough that election was for everybody. I mean, everybody felt one way or the other on it. Yeah, and I totally don't support President Bush. I never have. And never will. But, you know, I'm just saying, as far as the tolerance issues in the United States, where we're going with this whole, you know, let's feel sorry for everybody. You know, yeah, I can understand where they may be now. Of course they're sorry now.
I think it's mostly, though, the moral relativism that you're objecting to. It's
yeah,
the same problem
it
you have with the New Agers.
Which is different from simply being non-judgmental.
Yeah.
which I think actually is something that the spirit realm does encourage us not to judge others, to worry about dealing with our own stuff rather than pointing fingers. But one of the interesting thing, messages that came through from more than one medium was that there is hope to an end of terrorism in our lifetime.
Now, were you guys, Pam and John, I want to get this from both of you. Were you guys, how were you raised Christian? Were you raised Catholic? Were you raised, or were you raised in a like a more New Age kind of way? I mean, how were you raised, and how's your beliefs changed?
Well, I would say I was raised in a secular humanist household, agnostic / secular humanist. Go figure it out for yourself. No particular religions. Watch out for those bastards.
That's Chuck's brand of religion right there. You're not alone, my friend.
Well, my father was very much of an atheist, and my mother was more of an agnostic, and they just let us alone. And we never went to church or anything, but we certainly weren't particularly Christians. But when my father died, interestingly enough, I didn't mention this in the book, I don't think, that he came back about a week after he died and stood by my bed. To my satisfaction, I wasn't looking for proof or evidence, but it was very, very detailed. I can't really go into it much here, except that he was so bewildered because he didn't expect anything after he died. So he was kind of wandering around in this kind of half-lucid dream, kind of panicking like he didn't even know he was dead. Which always happens with some people, including suicides who didn't expect anything or were so caught up in the pain before they died that they can't even think ahead.
What were you thinking when you saw him?
When I saw him? Well, I moved into very, very rational kind of scientific, empirical testing, hypothesis testing gear. It's amazing that I did. I was lying in bed, and he's standing there by the bed, and I looked up at him, and I saw him. And I began to test out, am I asleep? Am I dreaming? Am I lucid dreaming? Am I hallucinating? And I tried to lift my hand to reach out to him, and I couldn't move my arm. I thought, oh, wait a minute. You know, normally when you're dreaming, you can't move the voluntary muscle systems if they're paralyzed, except for moving your eyes. And so I figured if I can't move my arm, I'm looking down at my actual body, not my dream body. Because if I was looking at my dream body, I could raise my dream arm and touch him if I'm only dreaming this.
Yeah.
But I couldn't. I was literally stuck in my physical body, looking through my physical eyeballs at him there in a somewhat normal state of consciousness, maybe somewhat altered. So I was doing all this kind of, what could it be this? Could it be this? Could it be this? I didn't exactly gullibly fall into, oh, that's my old man. It took quite a while. But finally, I believed it was.
No. What's that thing they call it, Chuck?
Paralysis?
Sleep paralysis.
It's the same phenomena that happens with the UFO abductions as well.
Yeah, there's a relationship there, yeah. And very often people try to paint the whole thing with one brush of sleep paralysis, whether it's UFO abduction, little grays coming in the bedroom, or seeing the spirit of your deceased father standing by the bed in either case.
Okay, Pam, what was your upbringing religiously?
Well, my grandmother had taught the adult Baptist Sunday school class.
Uh-oh. All right, go ahead.
My parents wanted us to pick our own religion, so they encouraged us to go to all the different churches in town, and even to learn about Buddhism and Hinduism.
So you were a Buddhist for how many years now?
I'm a Buddhist now, but I actually started out Baptist because they had the best donuts and orange juice, and I was not a dumb kid.
And you remember those little sugar cookies they used to have? Man, things were great.
We got great donuts and orange juice. Plus, our teacher was the Shakespeare teacher for the university, and you could get him talking about Shakespeare at the drop of a hat. So there we were with donuts and orange juice learning about Shakespeare in Sunday school, so it was perfect.
Shakespeare and Jesus, nothing like it. So,
I would consider myself more Buddhist now.
Okay. Now, Buddhism is a very, from what I know of it, it's a very self-absorbed. You're not really concerned with, you're concerned with finding your own pathway, and it's a struggle kind of. It's been a while since
I... It's not considered an organized religion, or at least...
Yeah, like I said, it's more... Yeah. Isn't it more derived from your internal... perspective, maybe?
It believes in reincarnation, and it focuses on personal responsibility, but that also includes being willing to help others.
Now, John, are you a Buddhist now?
No. I'm a panentheist, not a pantheist, where God is in nature. I'm a pan... P-A-N-E-N theist, panentheist, which technically means I believe that God is immanent in creation, in nature, creation with a capital C, but also transcends it. So it is its creation, but it also transcends its creation, and it is ubiquitous. Everything is God's stuff. Everything is God's substance. I'm also a philosophical idealist, fancy term for everything is consciousness. I believe when you go all the way down, it's not Newtonian billiard balls and physical reductionism is the ultimate reality. It's living consciousness and spirit that comprises everything that is. And that makes me very lonely in our culture because most people do not see things that way.
So you're kind of a deist.
Yeah,
to boil it down.
In a sense, I am. I feel I'm floating with a kind of a universal living spirit that I'm part of, and so is the furniture and the inanimate objects and everything. I paint it all with that brush. It's like materialists are going to paint everything with a physical or materialist reductionist brush. I paint everything with the opposite end of it, and I try to live my life that way, too.
Okay, okay. Huh. All right. have you guys seen
a simple answer there?
Have you guys seen the movie Jesus Camp? Have you seen the thing for that?
I've seen excerpts from it.
Isn't that wild?
It looks scary.
Oh gosh.
It does look scary, doesn't it? I can't wait to go see it. They're not showing it around
here.
Who
would send their kid there?
I would. But you know, I mean, look at these kids, man. It's some crazy stuff. No, I wouldn't send my kids there. I'm not big on the I like to call them the charismatics, but...
Well, the whole idea behind that is to create a whole second generation of suicide bombers here that we can send over there.
Oh, come on now.
Don't pull an Alan Colmes on me.
It isn't just Muslims that believe in survival. You know, in Allah, we've got Christians believing in survival, but it's usually a more constrained story about what happens after you die. And I don't think that the established church really addresses it all that well and explains it all that well. Like the last trumpet, when we all rise out of our graves on down the line at the end of time. It's not very clear. It's kind of a funny story.
Well, you know, the Christians don't strap bombs on themselves either and go into buildings full of other children and people.
Well, it depends on what era you look at as to whether they did it or not. I mean, that's...
I'm talking about now. But no.
No, this is not their time to be doing a holy jihad, holy war. But I wonder if you squint a little bit, could you imagine an extreme right wing kind of crusade oriented Christian fundamentalism that would be ready to strap something on because they know Jesus would love them on the other end, wouldn't give any virgins, but at least be wear with open arms the way the Allah is supposed to be for the Muslims.
Uh-huh.
Unless you're Catholic, then you go straight to hell.
That's right. If you're Catholic, you're going to hell.
Oh, yeah, hell.
So let's keep that open, guys. Suicide, the main thing, if you get anything from the show tonight, suicide is bad. And if you're Catholic, you're going to hell.
Not that it's bad. We're not passing judgment on it. It's that you probably won't get what you want. It's not a solution,
okay.
And it's not an easy out. And
you don't go to hell, particularly.
Yeah.
Particularly.
I love
how he prefaces everything.
I mean, the textbook, you know, the tried and true illustration of hell that you descend into it and never come out, that's what we tend to be taught about hell, and that's not what we're hearing from the other side that happens even with murderers, suicide murderers.
Now, I've got a question for you, John, that I'm going to come back to because I've got a question in the chat room I want to ask you from one of our listeners,
mm-hmm.
And that is, have they conducted or cataloged any physiological testing on those people who claim to channel spirits, anything to quantify as far as brain activity, that 90% that humans don't use, etc.?
There's a precious, precious little research, and you could sort of say funded research, in this area. I have to go back, actually, 15 years or so when I was involved or was privy to reports from research projects where they had the EEG, you know, electroencephalograph readings, and they've sophisticated this brain imaging stuff a lot. What we really do is to strap on the most recent brain imaging processes to see what parts of the brain are active when somebody is supposedly channeling or doing a mediumistic episode as opposed to someone who's just associating or having a subpersonality come out or it's their own imagination. We have not done enough research. The universities don't care about doing that kind of research. It's left for people sort of outside of the mainstream to try to do that research, and then how do they get the equipment and how do they get the funding for it? But I do remember when research was done, and I was there, when a trance channel would go into his or her state, and one of the entities would talk, or the main spirit guide would talk through that person, and they monitored the whole thing with a brain imaging, with the EEG, and they compared that with someone who didn't claim to be doing that, and who was just imagining doing it, or who was just with a multiple personality at that point, a multiple personality disorder person who had one of their subpersonalities come forth, and the brain imaging was quite different. And it what it was telling the traditionally trained scientists was, during the channeling episodes, the mediumship episodes, something different seems to be happening, but this was such a limited trials that we'd have to do much more research in this area. But I think it's a very good smoking gun realm to get into with research, is to see what the brain imaging has to do, and is there something uniquely going on during mediumship or channeling or psychic episodes that would rule out the other hypotheses about, well, it's just the unconscious, it's just personal dissociation going on, or something like that.
No, I think, you know, like with most of your graduate funding too. I mean, they're not going to give money for this kind of research. It's outside of that mainstream loop that they want to be associated with.
Well, you know, the U.S. government's got to be doing this, though. I mean, they fund remote viewing and I mean, precognition. So that's not all that far out of the realm of possibility.
That's right. I wouldn't doubt that they've strapped brain imaging equipment onto remote viewers in their own black budget research. But I don't know. They're not publishing it, so I wouldn't know.
And they probably won't.
Yeah,
They're going to keep those details to themselves.
Yep.
The question I was going to get back to, though, John, was a question that I had asked Dr. Heath earlier. Are you still with us, Pam?
Yeah.
Okay. And that was, how do you know that these things that you're talking to aren't demons and they're just leading you down the wrong path?
That is definitely one of the perspectives, or one of the hypotheses in various, you know, multiple explanation systems about what could ultimately be going on. But I don't think anybody that says that it's only demons, this is back to the Old Testament now, you know, don't do that kind of a thing, psychic stuff or wizardry or mediumship, because it's going to be demons right down the line. I don't think anybody can prove that it's demons every time. And I don't think, on the other hand, that you can prove the people on the other side who believe even things like channeling or survival of physical death or mediumship, they can't any better prove that it isn't demons. I think you have to be able to tolerate a lot of ambiguity and uncertainty, and kind of, it's not all one thing or all the other, I think. But what is a demon? I mean, a demon is probably a lost soul, you know, acting out its stuff and punishing and having, it really needs the mental health profession to do a little therapy with it, probably. And if there's something really deeply, deeply demonic that is so close to pure, unadulterated evil, either embodied or disembodied...
Well, even Dr. Peck talks
about
that.
I believe there is such a stuff. Then, there are. You can run into demons, and you can open yourself to them, I suppose, but I still would want to define demon a little more carefully, and I certainly wouldn't want to paint the brush so broadly that we're calling too many different things demons. It's probably just some poor, lost soul that doesn't have a physical body right now.
He's definitely a college professor, isn't he, Chuck?
We all have voices in our head. It's called intuition.
We do.
All right. I've chaired three different dissertations.
Oh, God.
That are where the subjects, the participants in the research, were licensed mental health professionals, were clinical psychologists, and the research was about voices in the head, inner guidance, inner voice, and how it's used in therapy.
Maybe that's my problem. Guys, we're going to have to take a break. And on that note, we'll be right back with more with Dr. John Klimo and Dr. Pamela Heath here on World of the Unexplained. We'll see you in a little bit. And we're back to World of the Unexplained. You're listening to us here live on Planet Paranormal Radio Network. You can give us, well, no, you can't. We're tying them up. Anyway, you can jump in the chat room, go to worldoftheunexplained.com, click on the chat button, make up a name, and come on in. Some of our party's gone to bed, and some of the party is still kicking, and so come on in, check it out. If you got any questions, just post them in the chat room. Tonight we're speaking with Dr. John Klimo and Dr. Pamela Heath about their new book, Suicide. And we were talking during the break about some of the things that I hope those suicide bombers burn in hell. Okay, it didn't happen for me, guys. And we're talking about a story with Nuri where they'd actually mentioned that, and the book flew off the desk and fell on the ground.
I didn't see it.
Yeah, I didn't see it happen either here. But, you know, hey, he's more popular than I am, and that's why. So we were talking about punishment, and we were also talking about... go ahead, guys. You wanted to talk about punishment?
The punishment part was that I was talking to somebody once, and they were when they heard that somebody who had not only killed themselves, which you can have some compassion about, but had killed other people in the process, that they were really murderers in the process, and they were intentionally doing that, that the response of the person I was talking to was the fry in hell one. They should just go into a void, into nothingness. There should be no afterlife to enjoy. They should just whatever. And I pointed something out. I said, you know, if you would believe in, if you would advocate lethal injection, you know, let's just execute them. I believe in capital punishment. Well, lethal injection doesn't, depending on whether you believe in an afterlife or not, it just finalizes the whole story. Whereas life in prison without possibility of parole, you kind of stew in your own juice and you have to just deal with the repercussions of it for the rest of your natural life. And which is worse? You know, the lethal injection and the pentothal goes in there and you swoon and you go unconscious and that's the last thing you remember forever and ever, possibly. Or you just sit in that cell for, you know, as the decades go by, driving you nuts and having to live with what you did and no exit. And the point I was making was that from all we hear from the spirit realm, when you commit suicide, you don't get out of your problems. You just procrastinate them, or you have to deal with it on another level in another way and repeat the story until the lesson learning occurs. So there's really no exit from what you thought the suicide would exit you from. But in the other realm about the suicide bombers and the terrorists, you are going to, it's like life without possibility of parole. You continue to have, on the other side or in other incarnations, you're going to live with the repercussions of those acts. You don't get off so easy as having some kind of quick out of the whole lesson learning cycle. If we had thought it was true, more people would be killing themselves and other people because they wouldn't have anything to have to stick around to deal with. And in this case, we're hearing from the spirit realm, oh, you stick around and you deal with it. No matter how much you kill yourself or how much you kill somebody else, that's not the end of the story. You don't have the power to end the story. You didn't give yourself that life. You can't truly take it away. And you're not really snuffing other people that you murdered till the end of time because that's not, they're immortal spirits and they have more living to do than that, the life that you took them out of. So it's not the end of story. So it kind of disempowers both the suicide and the suicide bomber in a way.
Okay. That's... That's good. He's very concise. I like that.
Yeah.
let's talk about, I was mentioning with you, Pam, about assisted suicide. And for those of you that don't know, the state of Oregon is currently the only state. It's been challenged constitutionally before, and it has passed. You know, Oregon is still allowed to allow doctors to help with suicide. What happens there, Pamela?
Well, they seem to be a very different case than either the suicide bombers or the traditional suicides. They seem to have very easy transitions. Most of them are welcoming death. They know they're going to die. They don't seem to have as much trouble understanding that they're dead. They see their spirit greeters right away, and very few of them had regrets. The only thing they would say, you know, they say, you know, we understand if your life is, you know, limited, you've got terminal illness, you're in great pain, you're suffering, or your family is suffering because they're paying money they can't afford to support you. You know, this is a very personal, individual decision each of us has to make for ourselves. But they do say make it very thoughtfully. There might have been reasons why you chose to experience this. There might be a certain amount of gain one can get from the suffering or allowing someone else to take care of you. But if you talk to the people around you and they're okay with you ending your life and you're okay with it and you've, you know, given it a lot of thought, careful thought, that it's okay, that there are not repercussions, that you will not be treated badly or, you know, you won't have the problems of a regular suicide, and furthermore, that the person who assists you will not be treated as a murderer, which is very interesting and perhaps a little surprising.
Well, it makes some sense. I mean, it makes sense that they would have an easier time transitioning because it's basically a mercy killing. I mean, I don't know. It makes sense that it would be a different case.
Not in North Carolina.
No, I agree. Or Michigan, for that matter, as Jack Kevorkian found out.
Actually, in any other state.
Speaking of Kevorkian, I was very challenged a few years ago by someone who was referred to me, who was a fellow psychologist who was about my age, too. She came to me announcing right up front, I'm a Jewish atheist that doesn't believe in survival of physical death, but I want to kind of hedge my bets, get a for further input. I'm planning to kill myself. I want to commit suicide. And she told me what the kind of pain she was in, the psycho-emotional pain, not physical pain. And, of course, that's debatable. You know, can that be more painful than physical pain or just different kind of pain? But that started 6 months of seeing her every week. And to make a long story short, it reached the point that she wanted me to Kevorkian her, if that's a verb.
Oh, man.
She didn't want to die alone. She didn't want to kill herself alone. She wanted someone to be with her. And she would get the pills or whatever. And she said, if you really support me and if you really care about me, this real humanistic psychotherapy, you would sort of be with me. And it took quite a while to go deep into myself about this, and I ended up saying, no, I will not be with you. I will not condone that, and I don't think you gave yourself that life, so you can't take it away, and I don't believe in suicide in that sense, and I hear the pain you say you're in. It was a complex kind of dissociative kind of a thing. She was kind of panicking. It was just very hard to be herself and be alive anymore. She was losing her mind in a sense, but she was a therapist, and she knew she could go to other therapists or something. And so I didn't support that, but she was saying, don't I have free will? And this is back to the secular humanist roots that I grew up with, you know, that we're each make our own heaven or hell. We have responsibility for ourselves, you know. What are these existential angsts and freedoms we're faced with? And here was a fellow human being saying, help me. Hear my pain, empathize with me, and help me end my life. And I could not do it. But it wasn't like a real knee-jerk quick thing right in the first time she brought it up. I had to really dwell on it and then eventually say, no, I won't help you in that way.
No, were you in private practice at this time?
No, I'm not a licensed mental health practitioner. I'm a research psychologist, academic psychologist. But other licensed professionals, mental health practitioners refer people to me when they're kind of tough cases. And she was on a weekly basis seeing her psychiatrist. So I would talk to the psychiatrist often about this. So the psychiatrist and I were working with her. I was sort of a specialist on death and survival, I guess you could say, doing psychoeducation with her or bibliotherapy or something, giving her things to read and then talk about them.
Are you guys familiar with the book? I think I'd ask you this, Dr. Heath, earlier, and I don't think you were, and maybe you are, Dr. Klimo. It was a book by Dr. George S. Ritchie. It was called... I can't think of the name of it now. I want to say it's Beyond Tomorrow, but I know that's not the right title.
Well, the name Ritchie isn't ringing a bell offhand.
Okay,
Tomorrow was written by Ruth Montgomery.
Okay, yeah, that's not the right name of the book, but it's hang on, I'm going to find out what this is. I'm going to get online here and find out what this is.
While you're doing that, let me mention that sometimes family wants to know what they can do to help suicides, successful suicides.
Okay.
And there are things that you can do. A couple things that are important. One of them is to let go of your own grief and guilt because they're aware of it and they're feeling it. The other thing is you can pray, you know, and it doesn't matter what your religious background is. Heartfelt prayer seems to really get through to the spirit realm, and they appreciate it. It can make a difference.
Okay.
Yeah, good point.
So
did you Google Ritchie yet?
I am, yeah. I don't think I spelled it
Amazon
right.
Is a quick way to...
Yeah, if we were talking about a book, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I spelled it right. Hang on, I'm going to try again.
Well, while you're doing that, man, I got a quick question.
Go for it, man. Go for it.
Thank you. Save us.
Hey, come on now.
I'm reading from my notes here.
God almighty.
So what's your guys' take on zombies, you know?
What?
yeah, seriously.
Zombies?
Zombies. The mysticism around voodoo, Haiti, New Orleans, what's the deal with that? Do you have any theories on that?
Pam, you want to start?
Well, I would say, having studied PK, and I talk about this a little bit in the PK zone, I do talk about voodoo a little bit.
Okay.
And they do seem to be able to do real mind over matter things. There are stories by fairly trustworthy sources that people can actually levitate and get stuck up high in trees during ceremonies, that they can be possessed. It's, a voluntary possession by spirits because it serves a purpose they feel. They can make them be able to be psychic and to answer questions, and like I say, and the thing that's really interesting is one of the sort of hallmarks of when real mind over matter is happening is you'll often get battery drain. And so this guy who kept trying to film this, it was driving him nuts. He was a professional photographer, and he had like 20 sets of batteries. All of them died. And then as soon as the PK was over, they were all fully charged again. And that's the same thing you'll see in ghost investigations.
Electromagnetism,
where,
yeah.
Where your camera suddenly, you know, the batteries die, and then when the ghost disappears, the camera's fine again.
Oh, yeah, we've had that happen.
Take a picture.
We've had that happen.
Another perspective on the zombies is that, you know, we see ourselves, even Christianity, I think, sees us as being spirits in bodies. In this lifetime, we are embodied spirit. We are spirits dwelling within a body that serves our purpose on this level of density, this physical level. And when we die, we cast off that heavy, dense overcoat of the body and operate on some other level. And when we go out of body, we do that. And in your death experience, we may also loosen the shackles of the body and operate free of it, at least transiently. So what is a zombie? Is somebody, is it still their spirit that is partially in the body? Is there no spirit in the body? Is it just a walking corpse? If it's a walking corpse that's got a glimmer of life in it, is it possessed by somebody other than who used to have the body? Did Elvis leave the building? Did the zombie who used to own the person who used to own the body, the spirit who used to own the body, the spirit's gone, then who's come back into the house of that body and is using it, kind of keeping it alive in a Frankensteinian way? I mean, there's ways to look at disembodied and embodied consciousness in light of zombiehood. And philosophers, by the way, if you look at the literature and philosophy, the zombie stories are used often to talk about consciousness in materialism, and zombie is a good talking point in philosophy.
Serpent in the Rainbow, man. Remember that movie, guys, in the 80s, wasn't it? Serpent in the Rainbow?
Vaguely.
It was about zombies. Yeah, it was based on a true story, apparently. It's a horror film called The Serpent in the Rainbow. And it was based on...
I've heard of it, though. Yeah.
There's very few true story ghost movies out there that have any truth to speak of in them. I mean, I know one of the guys who did one of the parapsychologists, Kerry Gaynor, who did the original investigation for The Entity. The movie's nothing like what... And the Amityville Horror, you know, total hoax.
No, I have to disagree. I know the lady that was there.
Those people who were there the first time, who did the investigation.
I do, too, and I'm telling you, she tells me, this is Lorraine Warren tells me for a fact this is the way it is. Now, and I don't know if that's true. I know that she believes it to be true, and I believe that she believes it to be true.
Well, Alex Tanis was there, and so were some other people I know. And... I mean, I don't know Alex personally. He's passed on. But some of the others who were with him at the time in that first investigation said, he said from the get-go, it's only place memory. There's nothing going on.
Hmm.
And then they all saw the contract for the movie, and they knew exactly why they'd been called in, you know?
Well, I found this guy's name, though, on another note. Dr. George Ritchie, in December 1943, the name of the book is Return from Tomorrow. And at the age of 20, he died in an army hospital. 9 minutes later, he returned to life, and what he talks about is that Jesus came to him and showed him the levels of heaven and hell.
Awesome.
Yeah, you've got to check this book out.
Okay, I'll get it. It's an often told story. I mean, Ritchie's story is, I think Pam and I have read that kind of thing numerous times. The near-death experience is very, very rich. We know PMH Atwater, who's one of the most published authors, and has had her own near-death experiences, which occasioned her getting into the whole field and becoming a researcher in that area.
Well, this story is
experience. It's a very, very interesting area.
This story is supposedly the story that moved Raymond Moody to begin investigating the near-death experience.
Uh-huh.
So I mean, maybe it's something you want to check out.
Yeah. But did you ever hear of Swedenborg, Emanuel Swedenborg?
The name's familiar.
He was a Swedish scientist and very accomplished, written dozens and dozens of books about hard sciences in his day, which was like the 17th, 18th century, sorry, 19th century. Well, toward the end of his life, he began to experience what he claimed was angels taking him out of his body and showing him, during these episodes, heaven and hell and purgatory, and he proceeded to write something like 1,400 pages of published book material about what the out-of-body experiences that the angels took him on to show him essentially what Ritchie was being shown in 8 minutes.
Well, 4 minutes, but yeah, wow.
Okay, who's counting?
No, I'm sorry. I think it's 9 minutes, actually. I was just joking, but yeah, I think it is nine, but wow. 1,400 pages, my God.
Yep.
What's wrong with these people?
The Swedenborgian churches around, based upon his writings.
There's a church for everything. Just go out to where you guys at, California. My God.
Detailed, yeah. It even looked at suicide by the women in India who were immolating themselves on their husband's funeral pyre and things like that.
So oh, yeah.
Sort of a much more detailed look at suicide than many writings.
What about, okay, fun time. What about the, have you guys had any communication with anyone that says, that claims that they've spoken with anybody famous, Elvis, JFK, Oswald?
Apparently not Hitler.
Yeah, apparently not Hitler, but any people that you guys just said,
well, Chris
whoa.
Chris Fleming of Dead Famous feels he's really connected to some, not all, but some of...
Chris is on our network, actually. His radio show is on our network, actually. Chris Fleming.
Spirit Talk.
Yeah, Spirit Talk.
He's contacted a few, and it's sort of interesting. Sometimes they'll come through and they'll claim to be a celebrity, and he doesn't buy it. And other times, he's felt like with John Wayne, he felt like he really connected.
Hmm.
He was on John Wayne's boat, which is pretty well known to be haunted by Wayne.
Huh. Wow.
And felt like
in my channeling book, in the new edition of it that came out in 1998, I have a section on different people channeling the spirit of John Lennon.
And I wouldn't make it a habit
really,
calling me that.
A leading band member and kind of a celebrity himself. He's a bit older than me. And he's working on a book on that, but he also, in the process, was contacted by something like 9 or 10 other people, all claiming equally to be channeling Lennon. And it's interesting to compare what the various Lennons are saying, and do they corroborate with each other. Ruth Norman, is some people may know the Unarius books. The Unarius is more UFO considered very often, but she was very prolific. She wrote about 100 books, Ruth Norman, and she was a channel of sorts. Some people think she was just making it all up, or was her fertile imagination, but she was a specialist in channeling the deceased spirits of many, many scientists, like Nikola Tesla, like you almost name the famous scientists from about the late 1800s through the mid 20th century, and she's got long treatises from them that were quite technical sounding, actually. They're not famous, but some of them are fairly famous.
Hmm.
But who knows? The more famous somebody is who's supposedly being channeled, this is the channeling source, the more I'm suspect about it, because I think it has something to do with ego and with fame and with the person on the earth side.
But also in the spirit realm. I mean, because if they want you to listen to them, if they want to get you to pay attention to them, you know, they might feel that you're going to listen to them better if they tell you they're King Arthur than if they say you're Uncle Joe.
Jesus Christ, too. That'll get your attention. Yeah. So Jesus, you got Jesus Christ on the line here. Watch yourself. And it's some
hotline to heaven.
Somebody drank himself to death, you know, 60 years ago.
Those poor celebrities can't even escape it after death, huh? You still got paper.
Hounded
all over you.
They can be from the spirit pretending to be someone they aren't, as well as wishful thinking, shall we say, on the part of the medium.
Oh God! I got a great thing from the chat room. I've got to say it.
Okay.
Does all this greeter stuff mean that Fred Sanford's greeter was Elizabeth?
What? Well, how's that go?
So the greeters we were talking
Sanford
about the greeters,
son.
Yeah, from Sanford and Son.
They're greeted by spirit guides.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, greeter on the other side. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a joke. It said, does all the greeter stuff mean that Fred Sanford's greeter was Elizabeth? It was a joke. Anyway.
That was a heart attack bit every episode.
Yeah, you know, he's like, oh, it's the big one, you know.
But, oh, okay.
Never mind. All right.
Well, it's interesting.
Academics.
They may be animals. They're not necessarily people who are greeting you. It might be a puppy dog or a kitten. Who's afraid of people.
I guess the question, do all dogs go to heaven? I mean, do you believe in animal spirits as well? I know my friend Joshua P. Warren just wrote a book about animals in the afterlife, and I was wondering what your views were on that.
Well, there are stories of of people on this side re-experiencing their dead beloved pet coming back to them, just like it's a human loved one coming back to them, and they get certain evidential stuff from it too. But you can never, how can you tease out that they just stop wish fulfillment and projecting and stuff? But in general, I believe from all the research I've done that there's a more of a group spirit to the animal world or to the different species, and you kind of join that animal, that group soul, so to speak. But at times you maybe get permission, or if there's a real love bond, you can sort of stay individuated away from totally dissolving into that pool and have some kind of ongoing survival outside of the group soul identity. But we're part of some group soul too, probably. Some human group soul or larger collection of our own higher selves.
Like Jung's collective unconsciousness or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah. And right now, you and me and each of us here are individuations, localized individualizations for a lifetime here embodied in a local personality, gathering experience to then pool back into that more group entity that we are part of, but not that we're not all of it, and it isn't, but it's all of us. And so maybe animals are like that too. They just because they're less individualized when they're alive, they're less prone to stay individual after they're dead and may not reincarnate as animals. But
there's
that's all speculation.
Possibility, which is that the spirit guides, feeling you won't accept them in human form, that they'll appear to you as a kitty cat. Because I said before, they can appear any way they want to. You know, just like a regular ghost can appear as a demon if he wants to, because it's nice and scary and it makes him feel good.
It all goes back to demons, doesn't it? No.
Well, I think we better end it on a demon note, you know.
All right, guys.
Halloween. Were you talking about Halloween the last hour?
I'm sorry?
No, were you talking about Halloween the last hour before it came on?
No, we haven't said anything about Halloween.
Let's end on demons and Halloween if you want.
We have a special Halloween show, actually. There's a guy with a website called corpsesforsale.com. He's going to be on. You should check this out, corpsesforsale.com.
They're not real corpses, though.
No, they're not real. They're made up. But he sells them for $700 in some cases.
Wow.
Yeah. Who would have thought, huh? Bottled water and corpses for sale. Who would have thought?
Bottled holy water, you mean?
Yeah, they do sell that, too. guys, last word. John?
Have compassion for people thinking of suicide. Try to help them. Try to keep them alive. We are here in the world for a reason, to face things and to make choices and to be responsible as living beings in physical bodies. There's a reason why we're here. Don't try to cop out on it. It's not going to get you anywhere. So stay alive. Don't contemplate suicide. Find someone to talk to, somebody, a listening ear, but stay in the game. We're here for a reason.
Okay, Pam?
And I would say call 1-800-SUICIDE.
Okay.
If you're thinking of suicide, seriously.
That's good advice.
Please, there are professionals who would love to help you. They're there for you. And, you know, there's also, if you pray for help, there will be an answer. It may not be the form you expect, but there is help out there for you. Please consider using it. My website is www.pamelaheath.com, and John's is www.johnklimo.com. And it's suicide, what really happens in the afterlife.
All right, guys, we want to thank you again for coming on World of the Unexplained, and we'll talk later.
Thank you for the opportunity, guys.
All right, thanks a lot, guys.
Good night, Pam.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye, guys. And that was Pamela Heath and John Klimo. All right, we got music. Is this yours?
Sort of. It's a hybrid, man.
Okay.
It's legit.
We've got a minute left, and then we got to get out of here. So, anyway, that was John Klimo, Dr. John Klimo, Dr. Pamela Heath. Next week, is next week the Halloween show?
I believe so.
I believe it is. We've got Molly Stewart from Salem, Massachusetts. We're going to do a pre-record with her. We've got a little surprise. I'm going to try to get a hold of the guy from the Monster Mash and get him on here.
That should be interesting.
That'll be pre-recorded as well. Then we've got live... I can't think of the guy's name now. His last name's DeStefano. Jamie DeStefano from CorpsesForSale.com. He's going to come on. And then this is a three-hour show. It starts at 7 p.m. Eastern and goes until 10 p.m. Eastern. And the last 2 hours, we're going to have writer-director Ethan Dettenmeyer back to talk about St. John Smith, and he's going to bring some wonderful surprise cast member on to the show. So that should be a lot of fun. So I'm Jay Scott, your only JD DJ on the Planet Paranormal Network.
And I'm Chuck Browder here, filling in.
All right. We're out of here, guys. Have a good night. See you next week.